Nan and I were baptized into God's church in the spring of 1971, just before the spring holy days. We were living in San Diego at the time, or just outside of town, and we attended services in San Diego. But we had dreams of greener pastures. We wanted to take our children out of that kind of polluted and populated area and find a better place to raise them. And so shortly after we came into the church there, we took off and did a tour on up the coast. And we kept searching around for some place to live. And we finally settled on the little town of Leavenworth in the Washington Cascades. And we rented a house there, and then we went back down to Southern California, loaded up our goods, and came back up to Washington. And we decided seriously to figure out where we ought to be attending services. And I thought for sure there'd be a church in Wenatchee, right? But no, it was either Spokane or Seattle. Well, we didn't want to spend every Sabbath day driving back and forth across the state, so we pulled up stakes again and we moved on over to Spokane. And we camped for many rainy days in Riverside State Park while we searched for a house and searched for a job. I did get a job at Custom Iron Works on East Sprague for something like $3 an hour. And we found a little house to rent and we kind of settled in. But our dream was to have our own place out in the country. And so we kept looking and we found a pretty little piece of land. The real estate ad said springs and apple trees. We got neither. We got a dry field and pine trees, but for $100 down and $50 a month, it was ours. And we couldn't afford to rent the house and to be making these land payments, and so we just moved out onto this raw piece of land and camped under the pine trees. I really don't know how Nancy made it through that first summer. We had no power, no water, no telephone, no refrigeration, no nothing, and she had two little kids to raise. And 1971 was a very hot summer. Some of the records that we see registered in, you know, on the news broadcast were recorded in 1971. And somehow she managed to do it. I'd go to work and I'd, on the way home, I'd buy a couple of groceries for dinner and I'd buy a bag of ice, and I think that the highlight of the day for Nan and the kids was to have a glass of cold water to drink. I also brought home rocks because we needed to build a house and I didn't have the money to get a concrete truck to come out, so we figured we'd make our foundation out of rocks. And I bought a pick and shovel, and we figured out where the house ought to be and started digging a ditch for our foundation. And slowly through the summer, we worked on that foundation. By the time the end of the summer rolled around, we had that rock foundation built. We also bought a truckload of wood from a demolition outfit. It was all used lumber. We got our floor joists down and we got a deck nailed over it. And it was time to think about putting up some walls or maybe even a roof when time for the Feast of Tabernacles rolled around. Let's turn to Leviticus 23 to start today. Just think about this. We had only known about the need to save our second tithe for half a year since that spring we came into church. Our savings account was gone from all the traveling and the moving and the renting and the building. I had only been employed for a few months, working 4 days a week in town, and had a pretty low wage, so our second tithe was not that abundant. We were camping out in a piece of raw land in a shelter that was hot when it was hot out, cold when it was cold, and wet when it rained. We did finally get electricity, and we got a refrigerator, but our only heat source was still that Coleman stove that we used for camping. Our house was beginning to take shape. We had a foundation and a subfloor, but we had a long ways to go. Summer was over, and it was getting colder. And to add to the interest of it all, Nancy was now pregnant with our third child. Given our circumstances, we could have said, you know, maybe we ought to sit it out this year and not go to the feast. In Leviticus 23, starting in verse 39, talks about the Feast of Tabernacles. It says, on the 15th day of the seventh month, when you have gathered in the fruit of the land, you shall keep the feast of the Lord for 7 days. On the first day there shall be a Sabbath rest, and on the eighth day a Sabbath rest. And you shall take for yourselves on the first day fruit, or branches, really, of beautiful trees, branches of palm trees, boughs of leafy trees, willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. And you shall keep it as a feast of the Lord for 7 days in the year. It shall be a statute forever in your generations. You shall celebrate in the seventh month. And you shall dwell in booths for 7 days. All who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord, your God. God wants his people to live in temporary dwellings for a reason. Now, we were in a temporary dwelling. This thing that we set up had kind of like a 2x4 frame, and it started out with some canvas on it. We wrapped some screening around it to keep the mosquitoes and the yellow jackets out. It was pretty hot out. We didn't need anything else. But as time went on, we added some clear plastic over the top, and I don't know if we ever got as far as tar paper or cardboard, but you know, it was covered with pine needles. You could say it was a tabernacle. We called it a cave or our gypsy camp. But weren't we already fulfilling this command? Why should we go to the feast? And that's my title today, Why Go to the Feast? And in this title, I underline the word go. Why go? You know, we keep all the other holy days right in our own church areas. Why does God command us to go? You know, why leave home to find a home? Is God being whimsical? You know, he figures the first holy days, I don't let them eat leavening. And the second couple holy days, I let them eat anything they want. And there's a holy day where they can't eat anything. So what should I do for these last couple holy days, you know? Oh, I know. I think I'll make them leave their houses and go somewhere else. That'll be different. You know, is God being capricious? Or is there something behind the reason why he wants us to go? Why do we plan all year? Save money, make reservations, pack all our clothes and our books, other gear. We take our kids out of school, we get out of our work, and we take off and go to the Feast of Tabernacles. You know what God does? He does for our benefit. Let's go to the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 14. God is trying to teach us something. Deuteronomy 14, starting in verse 22. Well, we'll just read verse 22 and 3. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year, and you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain, your new wine and your oil, and the firstlings of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. I looked up fear in vines, and it's not just a simple fear or a dread that we might have, but it's a reverence whereby an individual recognizes the power and position of the individual revered and renders him proper respect. Now, there are human beings that we learn to respect through the same process. Remember my drill sergeant in the Air Force? He'd tell us, when I say jump, you say how high on the way up. We understood his power and position. We knew the consequences of failing to obey him. And so we obeyed his commands. And we learned to respect the man through that obedience. And I guarantee you, if we did not obey him, we would never learn to respect him. When God gives commands, it's to help us learn to respect him and fear him. If we just backwards, to Exodus. Exodus 20 is the time when God gave us the Ten Commandments. Exodus 20, verse 20. Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you." So God gives us commands to test us. Are we going to obey him or not? that his fear may be before you, so that you may not sin. Obeying God's commands, we learn to properly fear him, and we honor him and respect him and stand in awe of him. We learn to truly love him through obeying his commands. Proper obedience, proper fear enable us to sin not, as it says here in Exodus 20, verse 20. So when the time for the fall holy days came in 1971, and I've talked to Nan about this, we don't remember even considering not going to the feast. Even though we had what some might consider a valid excuse, we realize that the first reason that we go to the feast is to learn obedience. God says do it, we do it. We simply took what few belongings we had and we stuffed them into the crawl space under this deck that we'd built. We tacked some Visqueen plastic over the top to keep the rain out. We packed the kids into our little trusty old Chevy carryall and we headed to Penticton. Now, I guess John was there in 71. I think probably many of the others were also. Spring or the fall of 71 was our first feast day up in Penticton, and we rejoiced in God's feast, as Leviticus 23 tells us to, and as John explained. We learned to fear God and began to learn wisdom. And the Bible does tell us that fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the value of wisdom is far above rubies. The Feast of Tabernacles, for us, pictures a time when we will no longer be physical, human, mortal beings, but we will be spiritual, immortal beings in God's kingdom. Sometimes we just can't see the forest for the trees. Going to the feast helps us get the big picture. We need some help back here. Going to the feast helps us to see the big picture. Most of the time, we're too close to the trees to see the forest. There is a forest back in Indiana. I guess it could be called a forest. It's several acres of trees. And you could go into this forest, and you could have a picnic, or you could walk among the trees. And if you looked around, you might notice that the trees are planted. Some are in a straight line, some are in different angles, and so on. But you wouldn't know what it was all about unless you got an airplane. And if you got in the airplane and went high above this forest, you'd notice that you were having a picnic in what is the world's largest advertising sign. Because when those trees were planted, they were set out in such a way that they'd spell the word Studebaker. And that's still there today, even 40 years after the company was dissolved. But when you're in those trees, you can't see what this sign spells. You don't even know what this sign. When we think of going to the feast, you know, we think of our destination. Are we going to Kelowna this year, or Bend, or Escondido? Some are going to Hawaii or England. But the first aspect of going to the feast is leaving here. Now that might seem pretty obvious. It might seem kind of trite, might even seem a little dumb, and we might not think of it too often. But maybe part of the reason God wants us to go to the feast is to make us leave here. Maybe he wants us to get up and get out of our familiar surroundings, all the things we depend on, the things we work on, the things that bother us, the things that frustrate us. You know, all the things that we're involved in our life, God wants us to be willing to put them aside, to get away from our projects and our jobs, our neighbor's dog, our junk mail, all the stuff that constantly bombards us and fills our lives. God wants us to be willing to get away from all the distractions, the things of daily life that get between us and God, and then to immerse ourselves into his way of thinking, with his people, at the place where he chooses to put his name. So let's consider leaving before we consider going. We're getting there. Let's turn to the book of Ecclesiastes. There's an old Jewish tradition that the book of Ecclesiastes is read during the Feast of Tabernacles. So I'd like to look at Ecclesiastes a little bit. Many of the people that write the commentaries think that the book of Ecclesiastes is an enigmatic book. They think it's kind of a riddle. In fact, they even wonder if it should be included in the canon of the Bible at all. And I think the reason they think this is because they just don't understand what the book of Ecclesiastes is trying to teach us. It's right after the book of Proverbs. I'd like to read some of this in the Living Bible because I think it's more picturesque. Ecclesiastes 1, and we'll just read starting verse 1 and 2. The Living Bible has it, "The author, Solomon of Jerusalem, King David's son, the preacher. In my opinion, nothing is worthwhile. Everything is futile." Now you can see why the commentary writers have a little problem with this. They look back in Genesis 1 where God created everything and he said it was all very good. And here the writer of Ecclesiastes says, no, it's all worthless. I'll go on here a few verses. "What does a man get for all his hard work? Generations come and go, but it makes no difference. Or as the King James says, the earth remains forever. The sun rises and sets and hurries around to rise again. The wind blows south and north, here and there, twisting back and forth, getting nowhere. The rivers run to the sea, but the sea is never full. And the water returns again to the rivers and flows again to the sea." Solomon starts to discuss the natural forces that take place on our planet. And he looks at a man's place in the scheme of things, at how small and insignificant a man is. And he says here, generations come and go and it makes no difference. You know, if a man is born and then dies, what difference does it make? Billions of people have been born, they've worked their lives out and they've died, and they've had no lasting contribution. The world just goes on and on. If all mankind disappeared, how long would it take for the forces of nature to totally erase all the evidence of his existence? You know, Nan and I are intrigued by the stories of the pioneers who traveled out on the Oregon Trail. We've read books about their joys and their sorrows and the trials and efforts as they traveled across this country, striving to start a new life in the Northwest here. We visited some museums. We've also visited some areas where you could still see the ruts from those iron-wheeled wagons that the people traveled with their gear out across the country. There was one particular place that was very memorable in Northeast Oregon. We followed these wagon ruts out across the prairie there that was covered with sagebrush. Followed them, it seemed like, quite a long ways. And it was kind of quiet and calm and very eerie out almost. As we traveled out there, we saw no signs of modern man. There were no telephone poles or fence posts or anything. And as we walked along, it seems almost like we entered the Twilight Zone, or we entered a time warp. It was very strange. Those wagon tracks were so fresh. It seemed like we could almost hear those wagons disappearing over the hills. And it felt like if we got to the top of the next rise, we could see the last wagon still disappearing. Those traces were so fresh after 150 years. But you know, geologically speaking, 150 years is nothing. A few more years are going to go by and those wagon ruts are going to be erased. In fact, if mankind disappears from the face of this earth, which he will, if Christ does not intervene, I-84, that parallels those wagon ruts, is going to be gone too. And so were the great pyramids of Egypt, the skyscrapers of New York City, and the mighty Grand Coulee Dam. They're all going to be just obliterated by time and the forces of nature. What Solomon wants to show us in the book of Ecclesiastes is that all gain apart from God, is worthless. Leaving our familiar surroundings and going to the Feast of Tabernacles helps to teach us this also. Keep a finger here in Ecclesiastes, because we'll be coming back. But turn back again to the book of Deuteronomy. Look in Deuteronomy chapter 8. Start in verse 6. Therefore you shall keep the commands of the Lord your God, which going to the feast is one, and walk in his ways and fear him. For the Lord your God is bringing you to a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of the valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you can dig copper. Now, these descriptions that God was giving at this time to the Israelites was specifically about the promised land, but think about the land we live in. We are blessed above all nations, and especially up here in the Northwest, we don't have to go far to see some of these things. We don't just have springs of water, we have mighty rivers. We have plenty of wheat and barley and agriculture that just won't quit when you notice driving around this state. It says that the stones are iron, and out of whose hills you can dig copper. We've got copper mines, silver mines, gold mines just within a short distance of here. God has truly blessed us. Then he goes on, he says, when you've eaten and are full, then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he's given you. Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, his statutes, which I command you this day, lest when you have eaten and are full and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and your gold are multiplied and all you have is multiplied, when your heart's lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. And drop down to verse 17, and it says, then, when you're blessed the way that we are, you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth. God commands us to forget the physical things that are so familiar that surround us, leave them behind, and go to the Feast of Tabernacles. Let's go back to the book of Ecclesiastes again. Ecclesiastes, I'm going to read verse 8 and 9. And again in the Living Bible, Solomon says, everything is unutterably weary and tiresome. No matter how much we see, we are never satisfied. No matter how much we hear, we're not content. And isn't that the way that the more you have, the more you want? History merely repeats itself. Nothing is truly new. It has all been done or said before. What can you point to that's new? How do you know it didn't exist long ages ago? We don't remember what happened those former times, and in the future generations, no one will remember what we have done back here. Those who don't learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them. And the poet Edna St. Vincent Millay said, it is not true that life is one thing after another. It's one thing over and over and over. And that's what Solomon's pointing out. It's unutterably weary. The physical things that we surround ourselves with are futile and they're worthless. Solomon then begins to expand a little bit to get a little more focused on what he's talking about. And he mentions some specific things. Starting in verse 12, I'll go back to the New King James. He says, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out wisdom concerning all that's done under the sun, this grievous task God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. And then down in verse 17, I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and perceive that this is also grasping after the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Now this again is strange, because in other places, in the book of Proverbs, Solomon lauds wisdom. He says, get wisdom. It's the thing that you need to go after. How would wisdom bring grief and sorrow? Well, apart from God, it has to. You know, I think of people like Jacques Cousteau, or the people involved in Greenpeace, who see that our oceans are being polluted beyond repair. And they're trying with all their might to save them. And they realize they're hopeless. These people have wisdom. They want to fight against this evil. And they're helpless because they don't know about the Feast of Tabernacles. They don't know God's plan. So for them, for people of the world, without knowledge of God, wisdom brings grief and sorrow. Other people fight against other evils. Nuclear waste, abortion, domestic violence, child abuse, whatever it might be. They're trying as hard as they can to do something, and they look around and they see things are only getting worse. So that wisdom has to bring grief and sorrow. Down in chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes, I'm going to go back to the Living Bible again. I said to myself, come now, be merry, enjoy yourself to the full. But I found this too was futile, for it's silly to be laughing all the time. What good does that do? So after a lot of thinking, I decided to try the road to drink while still holding steadily to my course of seeking wisdom. Next, I changed my course and followed the path of folly so that I might experience the only happiness that most men have throughout their lives. Then I tried to find fulfillment by inaugurating great works. I built homes and vineyards, gardens, parks, and orchards for myself, and reservoirs to hold the water to irrigate my plantations. He bought slaves, both men and women. Others were born within his household. He bred great herds and flocks, more than any of the kings before him. I collected silver and gold as taxes from many kings and provinces. You know, many of these things are things that all of us are involved in, just as people in the world around us. All these things that Solomon mentioned. Today we could add sporting events, television, the internet, SUVs, ATVs, jet skis, boats. Things that people just fill their lives with. And the thing that's really intriguing here is that these things are not evil. They're just worthless. All the things that to one degree or another, you know, we're involved in. I was telling you about the home that we built. We built gardens. We've got a grapevine. We've got fruit trees, you know. You go on and on. But it's where you put your emphasis that makes the big difference. You've seen the bumper sticker, whoever dies with the most toys wins. You know, that's a lie. Because whoever has the most toys, whoever follows them just has the biggest yard sale. You know? There's a little poem here I'd like to read. It's called Ozymandias. It's by Percy Bysshe Shelley. He says, I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on those lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, you mighty, in despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. You see, this man, Ozymandias, put all his stock in what he could do and the physical things around him. And they just turned to sand and got blown away across the desert. One thing that God wants to teach us through the book of Ecclesiastes and by having us leave our homes, our comfortable and familiar surroundings, is that all these physical things, as real and as important as they seem to be, have no eternal value. And we need to keep this in proper perspective. So he yanks us out of these familiar surroundings and has us go to the Feast of Tabernacles. The only thing we have that's permanent are those things which bring us closer to God. Well, we could go on through the book of Ecclesiastes and have this reinforced. But let's just go to the punchline, which is in chapter 12, verse 13, and I'm sure you all knew I was going there. You know, if you met Solomon at the end of your life and said, and tell him, you know, Solomon, I've lived a life of great adventure and wonderful accomplishments. And Solomon would say, so what? Because here in Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13, he says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man. I'd like to go to the New Testament and see if this theme is carried through. But before I leave Ecclesiastes, I'd like to mention that many people think that this is a depressing book because they read through it and they see that all these things, you know, they're worthless. And they think that's depressing. But really what Solomon wants to point out is the utter futility of all the efforts and all the pursuits of everyday life. And if we properly understand this, Ecclesiastes saves us all the frustration that we'd get if we searched after these physical things, looking for joy. The book of Ecclesiastes tells us where real joy is found. And I just want to look at a couple of verses that point this out. Ecclesiastes 3, verse 12 and 13. Ecclesiastes 3, verse 12 says, I know there's nothing better than to rejoice for them than to rejoice and do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. One thing that's interesting is every time you read about the enjoyment and joy in our life, Solomon points out it's a gift from God. Look at Ecclesiastes 5, verse 18 and 19. Here's what I've seen. It's good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of his labor which he toils under the sun, all the days of his life which God gives him, for that's his heritage. For every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him the power to eat it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. People don't like to work. Nowadays, work has a bad name. I heard a thing on the radio just the other day that now people are sleeping more, watching more television, and working less in this country. People shirk. They don't want to do a day's labor for a day's wage. And God says that you should enjoy your labor. Enjoy working. It doesn't sound reasonable, but it's like the endorphins that you get from aerobic exercise. God says you will enjoy your work, so put your heart into it. In chapter 9 of Ecclesiastes, let's start in verse 7, it says, go, eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart. God has already accepted your works. Let your garments be always white, in other words, obey God, let your head lack no oil, to take care of yourself, and live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which she has given you under the sun, all the days of your vanity. That is your portion in life, and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Our marriages should reflect joy, and this is consistent with the theme of Ecclesiastes, because when we go to the feast, we represent the time when the church will be married to Christ. And our marriages should reflect that. And if we can increase joy in our marriages, I think the feast is a great time to start doing it. Make a special effort with your marriage and your family. Well, let's go now to the New Testament. And just remember that what Ecclesiastes is telling us here, that apart from God, things are worthless. Things are. Let's go to Matthew chapter 16 now. And again, see if this theme continues on into the New Testament. Matthew 16, starting in verse 24. Jesus said to his disciples, "If anyone desires to come to me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life, whoever clings to his life, hangs on to the things around him, he's going to lose it. Whoever loses his life or is willing to give it up, willing to leave these physical things behind for my sake, will find it. For what is a man profited if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul?" This word soul is exactly the word that's translated life just in the verses before it. The only real life that we have is when we're willing to get rid of these physical things behind us. If we cling to our life, we lose it. If we're willing to leave it behind, which is pictured by going to the feast, we will find true, full life. Remember what Paul said, "If in this life only we have hope, we are of all men most miserable." Let's go forward to the book of Luke. Some very intriguing things that Christ had to say in the book of Luke, chapter 17. Luke 17, we'll start in verse 26. Christ said, "As it was in the days of Noah, so will it also be in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot. They ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built." These are exactly the things that Solomon was talking about. And again, none of these things are evil. They're things that we all do, we all must do in this life. But Noah was a preacher of righteousness. Apparently, he stood there, he worked on his ark for 120 years, apparently, and people would come by and say, "Noah, why are you building this boat? You know, it's a long way to the ocean." And he preached, Noah was a preacher of righteousness. He told people what was going to happen. But like Christ said here, the people were too busy to listen. And you know that nobody except for Noah's family went on that boat. And the same thing with the days of Lot. His own son-in-laws wouldn't even leave with him. They were just too busy. They had better things to do. Everybody I talk to seems to mention how extremely busy we are today. We're going faster and faster. We've got too many things to do. We talk about being in a rat race or living on a treadmill. We're treading water. We're all just going for all we're worth. So let's go down to verse 30 and 31, where Christ again says, "So will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed." So quiet, peaceful times are behind and people are just going faster and faster. "In that day, he who is on the housetop and his goods are in the house, let him not come down to take them away. Likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not turn back." God's saying, stop. Drop whatever it is you're doing. Obey me. Serve me. Come to the Feast of Tabernacles and rejoice before me. And he says, remember Lot's wife. Lot's wife looked back, apparently longing to go back into Sodom. The children of Israel looked back to Egypt. Same way, when God was in the process of moving them to the Promised Land. People didn't have vision. We have to have vision. Go to the feast. Learn what it's all about. I've also heard people say that God is not blessing the church these days because we don't have a tremendous increase of attendance like we used to have years ago. I think it's because people just aren't paying attention. They've got better things to do. They don't want to be involved in this because they want to go whatever it is they do with their physical things. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 22. Matthew 22 will start in verse 2. Again, this is Christ speaking here in a parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who arranged a marriage for his son. And he sent out his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding. And that's the work of the church now, to send out the invitation for that wedding. And the people were not willing to come. Again, he sent out other servants, saying, "Tell those who are invited, see, I've prepared my dinner. My oxen and fatted cattle are killed, and all the things are ready. Come to the wedding." But they made light of it and went their own way, one to his own farm, another to his business. See, people are just too busy. They've got better things to do. They let their lives get clogged up with all the physical things that surround us and get in their way, and they reject God's invitation. And the thing that we need to learn is that this can be a problem for us too. You know, we can become sidetracked by being too involved in physical things. And we can let them crowd God out of our lives. And we can lose our invitation. But by dropping everything, by getting up, obeying God, and going to the Feast of Tabernacles, we can keep things in a proper perspective. We need to leave here, the physical, and we need to be willing to go to the spiritual, to go to where God places his name. Well, in the process of going to the Feast of Tabernacles, we need to travel. And there's an article in the United News from in the August issue about planning a better feast trip. And the author mentions taking opportunities to go to historical and recreation sites along the way. And then he mentions that they went to the Grand Canyon. And he said it was our first time to see one of the most breathtaking geological sites in North America. Now, we are blessed in the Northwest here with having some pretty incredible geological sites of our own. And many of you might not be interested in geology, but we can learn a lot by looking at it. We can see, we can picture what Solomon was trying to point out. It helps us to realize our own significance if we look at some of these tremendous geologic things that we see. Remember in the book of Romans, God said that his creation could teach us about his ways. And the geology that we see around us, especially up here in the Northwest, is just pretty phenomenal. When we see it and when we understand what happened to form some of these things, we can realize that the things that we consider to be permanent and rock solid are actually not permanent at all, but they're quite temporary. We need to open our eyes and see what God teaches us, even through physically traveling to the feast. One of the things that we can see in the Northwest here are volcanic mountains. We all saw what Mount St. Helens could do, a very actually minor volcanic explosion there. A couple of weeks ago, Nan and I were backpacking up on the Pacific Crest Trail just outside of on the edge of Mount Adams, and we camped above the timberline there, and when we set up our tent and all, we just sat back in camp and we just stared up at that beautiful mountain, and it had fresh snow on it from the rain of the previous week, and it was absolutely beautiful. And we looked straight up the Adams Glacier there and just marveled. It was incredibly beautiful. But we realized that if Mount Adams did what Mount St. Helens did, we would be history. You wouldn't even find any of us, remains of us, up on that mountain. We live on the Columbia Plateau. The Columbia Plateau encompasses the whole Northwest. Washington, Idaho, Oregon, Northern California are all sitting on top of a huge lava shield. It's up to 5,000 feet thick. If you go to Riverside State Park, you can see several layers of these Columbia basalt columns packed on top of one another with the discontinuities in between. And you can realize that lava flows, one after another, have built this tremendous lava shield up. What if that happened again? Just a little. What if 10 feet of lava were to cover the same states that I just mentioned? What would be left? You know, all that we have, all that surrounds us, is extremely temporary. There's evidence as you drive across the state of the Great Ice Age Missoula floods that form the Channel Scablands. You can see that particularly just outside of Ritzville and many areas. Huge floods swept across the state of Washington and just flushed it out into the Pacific. What would happen if that came again? Or if you're going to Kelowna, you'll be traveling up through glacial valleys. You can recognize glacial valleys by their U-shaped cross-section. The streams that come out of glaciers look like milk. They're so full of crushed rock. The rock is so finely powdered that it forms a colloidal suspension. You take a glass of that water and it just stays milky looking. The rock is so finely powdered it won't even settle out. Think of what would happen if a glacier hit a city. Or what if the glaciers melt? Dan and I are going to Alaska for the feast. We're going to be traveling up the Inland Marine Passageway. We're going to be looking at lots of glaciers. If those glaciers melt, what's going to happen to all the coastal cities? And of course, we're looking at our daily news, the hurricanes and the tornadoes that are ravaging the South, the flooding. See, all the forces of nature will erase mankind permanently in short order apart from God. And that's one of the things that we want to learn by going to the Feast of Tabernacles. 2 Peter chapter 3. I can't complain about my computer making me do things wrong because I use a pencil. Sometimes it's hard to read. How come I can't find what I'm looking at? Okay, verse 10. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with great noise. The elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire. The elements will melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Again, all these physical things that we look at that seem so real, that seem so comfortable, that make life so nice, are absolutely worthless apart from God. So why should we go to the feast? We go to the feast because God commands us to. We go to the feast to learn to fear properly, fear God, to learn to revere and respect and love him. And we go to the feast to picture leaving this temporary physical life behind and going into God's permanent spiritual kingdom. If we keep these things in mind, we will have the best feast ever.